You can't help but wonder if Ruth and Roxanne are having a conversation.
All three of them, Mary Ann too.
That's right. That's right. If you turn your Bibles to James chapter 1, hopefully we're going to take this study up a notch. Did everybody get a sheet of paper? All right. Steve, it's good to have you back with us. That was a rough bout, wasn't it? Did Don give that to you? Well, we're always trying to look for someone to blame. Right. That's biblical. Yeah, scapegoat's biblical. I don't know if we used it biblically. The audience that James writes to are people that have been going through very difficult times. I think sometimes we misconstrue this book because we don't fully comprehend not only what they're going through, but who these people are. So let's see if we can just really nail it down. These clearly are people that are scattered abroad because of their faith. This is the key point. This means that they're suffering because they have already taken a stand. They've already made decisions. So they really are not in the realm of the superficial on the whole, as James writes to them. These are people that have been following God. The point is that God has taken it up another notch with them. And this thing called endurance is that which will do it. We come to know the Lord and we make a decision. We make a decision to follow Him. We make a decision to take a stand. We make a decision to do what's right. And oftentimes that walk causes us stress and difficulties. But usually the problems that face us are fairly short-lived. In this particular context, what he's dealing with is not short-lived. What he's dealing with, as he writes these people, is longevity of trials. This takes it up a notch. And there is good reason for it, because there are certain things that can really only be produced through a process of time. We all kind of lie to ourselves. I mean, we would like to feel that we've got everything covered, that we're pretty much on target. But the one thing about difficulties that are drawn out is that they begin to reveal things that we didn't even know were there. Because the process of time, it's like Chinese water torture. The process of time, you know, is hitting you over and over and over and over again. It brings you to those precarious breaking points that you would have overlooked, ignored, not even perceived that you had. So this thing of endurance, this trial of continuance, is necessary in our lives to bring us to a maturity. When you and I are born, John chapter 3 tells us that there is a new birth, a spiritual birth that actually takes place in our lives when we come and receive Jesus Christ. You don't want to stay a newborn. The desire is to grow, and as Philippians 3 says, as Paul would say, you know, we press on towards the mark of maturity. We want to actually mature. We don't want to just stay in this state. And you think about, you know, people enlisting in the service, and they don't want to just stay an enlisted person. Hopefully they want to at least go beyond private first class and maybe, you know, E1, maybe go E2, I don't know. But the desire is not to stay. The desire is to move on. And God is moving these people on to a higher plane. That higher plane is going to reveal things to them that I think are difficult to see. Because I think initially we receive Christ, you know, yes, we take those stands and we make those decisions, and there's certain sacrifices that we make. But when you go through trials such as this, it begins to take you from, well, when you're saved, you literally let go of bad and went into the realm of good, didn't you? But this trial is going to take you from the realm of good into the realm of best. That's a pretty intense movement, because many of the things that we hold so tenaciously onto are not bad things. They're good things. And this is why he lists the people that he does as examples to these that are going through the trials. He is telling them there are good things that you're going to have to let go of in order for you to move on to the realm of maturity. Now, instantly when you say something like that, it just goes against our grain. Wait a minute, they're good things. Why should I let go of good things? Because God has something better. And what God is going to do is he's going to move you from the realm of good into the realm of faith. I mean, literally walking by faith, putting your trust in God. Because there are things that we perceive that are good and beneficial, as Proverbs, and we've oftentimes quoted, there is a way which seems right to a man, but the end thereof is death. And though there are these good things that we pursue, they are not what God has intended for us, and God has something far greater. It is with great reluctance that we let go of those good things, because they're perceived as good. And so as we list the different ones, and I want to look at the sheets, we've kind of covered the individuals that have been listed and are listed from the Old Testament, as James will give mention to them. But if you look at the top of your sheet, we put as a title, Working Through Anger by Faith. And how we're going to start off in that process is we're going to have to trade in that which is valuable to us for faith. So those wonderful, valuable things that we perceive as good, we're going to have to let go of them. My father-in-law, from time to time, would remind me of a story about my wife when she was a little girl. He said they were all kind of sitting around outside, and they didn't know where Connie was. I think she was, you know, somewhere between 5 and, I don't know, 7 or something like that. And all of a sudden, he heard this blood-curdling scream. He said he never heard anything like that. He just knew that the dog was eating her up, or somebody was trying to take her, or something to that effect. And so everybody just dropped everything and ran out. And they saw a little girl standing with her lollipop missing. And she had been screaming because a dog ate her lollipop. The point of the matter is that none of us like to have that which is valuable taken from us. And when it happens, by George, we're going to let you know. And the list that he gives within the context here is a list of individuals that are going to have to let go of some very valuable things to them. And as we talked about last week, you know, everybody has their, you know, value treasures. Everybody has their sources. And, you know, I mean, you look at one person and you say, well, I don't know why they're not having a hard time. I mean, they shouldn't have a hard time giving that up. That's so easy, you know. But, you know, to a kid, that lollipop's pretty important. And so whatever it is, and I think in a way, I personally feel that as we look at this particular list, what we're looking at is a list of goods, good things, valuable things, that these individuals, because look, by the time you're scattered abroad for your faith, you've already let go of the superficial. I mean, that's gone in probably the first 5 hours. you know, you have to move on because of your faith. You either believe what you believe or you don't. If you don't, then you clearly just stay and go along with the system. But if you've made a decision, then you're scattered abroad. You've already gone past the realm of surface. You're now in the realm of, okay. But God is not finished with us yet, and he's moving us to that realm of maturity. As we look at Abraham, we look at Rahab, we look at Job, we look at Elijah, they value different things. And if you look off to the side of each one of them, and what I've tried to do is I've tried to quote you the verse that is specific to these individuals. In other words, in the book of James, I've tried to give you the verse that is listed for these individuals and how they're really scattered scattered in this particular book. I will also kind of give you a notation where these individuals can be found in the Old Testament. For instance, Abraham is, you're going to see him in Genesis chapter 12. That's pretty much where he picks up. And you'll take it all the way to Genesis chapter 25, and that'll be the end of his life. So those verses, chapter 12 through 25, will pretty well cover Abraham. If you were to kind of do a personality study on Abraham, I think you would find something similar to what I've come up with. Might add some other descriptive words other than what I put. But on the whole, you kind of get an idea of what kind of person this guy is and his character and his nature and that which is unique to him. If you look off to the side, it says, what we've tried to do is give you the qualities that this person esteems, the qualities that they value. And therefore, they're the qualities of this person. They've begun to live. And if you look at the list on the whole, the list are good things. They're good things. If you look at the esteemed qualities of Abraham, they are peaceable. That's a good thing, right? Amiable, kind of easy to get along with, you know. Why did we put amiable, by the way? Why would I throw that in? Remember the incident with Lot? Right, right. Yeah. Let Lot have whatever land he wants to. I don't want to argue. I just don't want to argue with him. And immediately you begin to get a picture of Abraham. In fact, he really doesn't even want to argue with Sarah. I think you ought to do this. Okay. I'm going to argue with you. Just kind of get that feeling with him. He's a very peaceable, amiable person. We understand him to be extremely helpful and extremely loyal. How do we know that? Well, when Lot was taken off, he pulls out his 300 men and goes out to get him. I mean, he literally fights a nation to go rescue his nephew. You know? Lot chose the best land. I'd say, no, let him have it. Deserves it, you know. Not Abraham. He's going to go get him. And he goes and rescues him. Extremely loyal, extremely helpful. And, you know, that's a big deal for somebody that is peaceable and amiable. I mean, for somebody like that to go to war, you know, he's got to feel very strongly about things. And so here you have this peaceable, amiable person, and when he gets the issue with his wife, he tries to be accommodating. But of course, that's going to get him ultimately into a lot of trouble. I think one of the problems that he had was that, you know, he tried to be so accommodating that he actually, when he gives his wife what she wants, of course, Genesis 16, I think verse 5, his wife turns to him and says, you know this evil that you've done by listening to me? It's never going to leave you, you know. I can just see Abraham, what do I do? You know, just like most guys, you know, by the time you finish. But it's just trying to be nice. Forget about it. But loyal, accommodating, and clearly protective. These are good qualities. If you look at his most valuable possessions, clearly it's relationships. I mean, that's very clear with Abraham. He's about his relationships. I mean, he could care less about the land. He'd care less about, even though he's a very wealthy man, probably one of the wealthiest at the end time of that particular region. Doesn't really care about this stuff. What he does care about is his wife. I mean, a guy tries to give him when his wife dies property. He says, look, you can have the property to bury her. He says, no, I'm going to pay for it. I want to pay full price. You can see that the relationship is very important with him, and ultimately his heritage, his future descendant, progeny, offspring that we have listed, of course, that's Isaac, right? There's nothing more valuable. What God will have him do is give up that which is most valuable to him. I mean, can you imagine somebody that is peaceable, loyal, protective, and that which he values the most is family? And then God says, okay, take him up, put him on the altar, and sacrifice him. Why would God have him do that? Well, there's only one answer to that. Because that was the good that he was holding on to. That was the one thing that was holding him back from best. And I think this is where we argue with ourselves in our minds. We go, well, it's a good thing, it's a good thing. God says, yeah, but it's not, you're not trusting me. Your life is immersed in this good thing, and you think that I'm pleased with that. I'm not. What I want you to do is do what I tell you to do and put all of your trust in me. And so God will push you to the limits and push you oftentimes in realms in which you feel very uncomfortable because it's moving in on your good stuff. It's moving in on that which is valuable to you. An interesting passage in Psalm chapter 27, if you turn there, and every one of these psalms that I've listed here to give an example of this are psalms of David. And if you'll look with me in Psalm chapter 27, of course, this is a psalm of David. The psalm says this in Psalm chapter 27, and if you'll drop down with me to verse 7 as he begins to cry out to the Lord. Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice, be gracious to me and answer me. When thou didst say, seek my face, my heart said to thee, thy face, O Lord, I shall seek. Do not hide thy face from me. Do not turn thy servant away in anger. Thou hast been my help. Do not abandon me or forsake me. Now, let me just say this. That's going to be kind of the key phrase here that I want you to listen to. Don't abandon me. Why? Because at this juncture, he is perceiving God as the only help he has. David was a very relational guy, as well as Abraham. And, you know, you oftentimes hear people, you know, the newscaster interviews people, what's most important to you? And some people say, you know, football or, you know, popcorn or something. But some people say family. Family's most important. Well, David and probably Abraham would be in that realm. Family's most important. I would say, okay, that's good. But you can't put family in front of God. You just can't do that. It's going to be your Achilles heel. David was very concerned about affirmation from his family. At a very young age, of course, a young person, he wants his dad to say, good job, kid. But we know that when Samuel was going looking for a king, he went through all the sons of, you know, Jesse, and, you know, none of them are really chosen. And there's another one that is mentioned, you know, he says, do you have anybody else? And ultimately, when he goes down the list, he even throws in a grandson. And then he turns and he says, anybody else? He goes, I got this little kid out watching the sheep. I got to go to this guy. So right from the start, David really wasn't perceived as anybody special. He was a low man on the totem pole and was not that valued. He goes out to his brothers as they're fighting the Philistines, and, you know, his brothers say, get out of here. What are you doing here? You don't belong here. You're just showing off. And you can hear the voice of David. What'd I do? What'd I do? When he finally kills the giant, much to the chagrin of his brothers, I'm sure, because of the jealousy that was there. You would think that Saul would be rejoicing because he's the king, and, you know, now the pendulum is starting to swing in their favor. And Saul's really not very kind to David at all. And as the time goes on, and I don't want to do a study on David, but as the time goes on, Saul tries to kill David. The very person David longs to have affirmation from is rejecting him. And you'll see repeatedly in Samuel, you'll see David crying out, "What'd I do?" He even turns to, you know, Jonathan, the son of Saul, and he goes, "What did I do to your dad? Why would he hate me? Why does he hate me?" You know, whatever Saul asks him to do, he does 10 times better. And it seems like the more he excels for Saul, the more Saul hates him. And David just doesn't get it. In this particular psalm, I want you to read with me in verse 10, as he cries out to God, "Don't you abandon me." Now, look at the very top, Psalm 27. Who writes the psalm? David. So verse 10, it's his parents that he's talking about here, isn't it? Right? "For my father and my mother have forsaken me." Do you know how devastating that is to somebody that cares about relationship? Do you have any idea? I mean, I've seen some people, they go, forget about it. But certain people feel very strongly about that. And David was one of them. In Psalm chapter 38, if you look with me in verse 10, by the way, Psalm 38 starts off, who writes the psalm? David, okay. He says in verse 10, "My heart throbs, my strength fails me, the light of my eyes, even that has gone from me. For my loved ones and my friends stand aloof from my plague, and my kinsmen stand afar off." Psalm chapter 55. Psalm chapter 55, and we'll pick up in verse 12. By the way, who writes the psalm?
David,
okay. Verse 12. "For it is not an enemy who reproaches me, then I could bear it. Nor is it one who hates me, who has exalted himself against me. Then I could hide myself. It is you, a man of my equal, my companion, my familiar friend, we who had sweet fellowship together." I believe he's talking about his son Absalom, myself. "We walked in the house of God in the throng." I can just see him looking at his son. "We were best buddies. What happened?" God will oftentimes take you down very difficult roads if this is what you value the most, so that you can go into the higher realm of faith, putting your trust in God. Because, look, we feel like everything's going along fine because that which is valuable to us is going along fine. You know, to a person who is really into relationships, they could lose all the money. They just don't even care. It doesn't matter to them. But they lose that relationship. That's big stuff. And I'm sure it was true with Abraham to lose, you know, for his wife to be angry at him. I mean, he's trying to be accommodating to her. And Abraham, you've messed up. You know. And ultimately, when she turns to him and, you know, Hagar has Ishmael as a son, and at the time they start growing up and Ishmael starts bothering Isaac, and Sarah goes, "Get that lady out of my house and get the kid out of my house too." And that's Abraham's son. In every case, Abraham's having to let go of relationships. Have you ever noticed that with the study? What is it he's having to let go all the way? Relationships. To ultimately, it accumulates and comes to the point of culminating about him giving his son and putting him on the yoke. With Rahab the harlot, you have listed here, if I were to share with you her esteemed qualities, and let me just say this as we're going through the list, I think that there's going to be one or two that you're going to identify with. And once again, you know, I mean, look, to a person that would write down, you know, what do I esteem, my car, you know, okay, so you're not there yet. But what we're talking about within this context are people that really have already made a full commitment. But God has taken them to a higher level. And Rahab the harlot, which is interesting about Rahab the harlot, because she's almost jettisoned right into a full commitment. I have seen this, of course, you go over to a lot of the third world countries, and oftentimes when they receive Christ, I mean, it's life and death that day. And it's like almost instantly they're into the realm of the mature. They have to mature fast, almost overnight. But Rahab, if you look at her qualities, good qualities, I mean, she clearly is a responsible individual. She's caring about her family. She's practical. I mean, what's wrong with being practical? What's wrong with being pragmatic? It's one of the things that James is going to be talking about. In particular, I think he touches upon it in James 2 and James 4, hits upon it in James 3 as well. But the tendency of man to try to figure out things so that his life just works. I mean, you know, you got to make ends meet, right? Got to make ends meet. So if that means that, if that means that you're going to cater to somebody wealthy, if it means that you have to cater to somebody wealthy, then you cater to somebody wealthy because, you know, you cater to a poor person, they're not going to pay the rent. So it's just practical, right? And what we know about, James chapter 2, verse 25 actually defines her as Rahab the what? Harlot. So it's actually telling us what job. And of course, you know, Proverbs tells us in Proverbs 6:26, you know, to a harlot, a man is reduced to a loaf of bread. In other words, what does she see? Income. Right? She sees a loaf of bread or a loafer. But the point is that she sees income. She's in it for the money. They actually say psychologically, most harlots hate men. But they know they need the money. And so she's very practical, pragmatic. She's going to use people to survive. I mean, if you have to do it, you have to do it. It's just the way of life. She clearly is a brave individual, and she obviously is maternal in that she's very protective of her family. If you were to ask Rahab, what is your most valuable possessions? What is it you value the most? She would tell you family, security, safety, stability, shelter, and sustenance. On this particular day, this woman will have to jeopardize security. 100%. Everything that she had always, and it's just an interesting metaphor that she's, her house is in the wall. You know, I was talking to Diane, or I guess emailing him. That took me a while. When you look at the archaeology of that particular wall, and they say that the wall of Jericho just literally, from all documentation, just collapsed. An amazing thing. But the outer part of it is, the wall was 6 foot thick, and then you have about 12, 15 feet of house, and then you've got another 12, 15 feet of wall. So, you know, your homes are in this wall and structure, and it's a part of the security. I mean, you know, they took a lot of pride in the fact that, you know, nobody's going to break through this place. Rahab had gotten a position in the wall, and security is a big thing. This day she'll relinquish everything that she knows about safety, about security, about sustenance. She'll give up her job. This day she's going to give up her job. I mean, the only source of income that she knows. I mean, she's going over with these Jewish people that actually have scruples. She's going with these Jewish people that have morals, and she's out of a job. But she goes, and she surrenders these things. On this particular day, God calls upon her to surrender. Will you surrender everything to put your trust in me? And she does it. She does it. That's what's amazing about her. If you look at Job, Job esteems the qualities of conscientious, or he is conscientious. He is circumspect. That means he's very thoughtful and prudent. He's very cautious about the way that he does things. He tries to do them right. He's scrupulous. He's moral. He's ethical. He's a person with strict regard to these practices. You know, when you say somebody's scrupulous, you're saying they strictly regard those things. And this is very true about Job. He's very devout. He's devoted to God. He's very judicious, discreet, wise, discerning, sound in judgment when he makes a decision. That's what that means. Very much self-disciplined and a man of distinction. There's no doubt about this. If you were to ask Job what's important to him, he would say, my reputation. When you read Psalm chapter 4, you can hear the psalmist, you know, he's very upset. And if you were to ask, what's he upset about? It's his reputation. I know that seems like a strange phenomenon today, because I don't think a lot of people are really concerned about their reputation or how they're viewed. You know, as long as you pay them enough money to be on, you know, TV, they'll give it all up or whatever. But reputation and dignity was a big issue with Job. It actually seemed to trump family with him. Reputation, dignity, integrity, his achievements. I mean, as you read Job, the book of Job, you begin to see all the lists that he has. I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this. His achievements are very important to him. And we put in there actualization. What that means is that to him it was important to take your ideals and your standards and make them real. That was important to him. Which, in a way, I think this is what, you know, the book of Job is about. You know, now you say you believe this, make it real. And so you read through the book of Job, and he goes, I did what I said I was going to do. You know, I had this list of standards, and I did that. I lived by that. And that actualization is pretty important to him. He wanted some sort of recognition. In fact, we read in Job chapter 29, you know, men used to cover their mouth when I spoke. And you could tell that was important to him. Clearly, to Job, ambition and to excel is important. You know, some people are just happy being couch potatoes. Other people, they want to own the universe. And to Job, he had to excel. That was very important to him. And he needed to advance. When you read the book of Job, he will have to relinquish his reputation. This will be the biggest blow to him, because upon that foundation is where everything else will crumble. His dignity, his achievements, his actualization, everything will crumble at the destruction of his reputation. And he will literally have to relinquish that in the process of the trial, in the process of the tribulation. As you look at Elijah, I think outside of Ecclesiastes, your favorite phrase is here in James 5. Elijah was a man with a nature just like ours. And, of course, that's listed there in James chapter 5 in 17 through 18. It gives the example of him praying, and it tells us that he prayed earnestly that it might not rain for 3.5 years, and then he prayed again, and the earth produced fruit. Elijah, if you were to talk about his esteemed qualities of this man, if you were to, and 1 Kings 17, if you were to take 1 Kings 17 and go all the way to 2 Kings chapter 2, that would be fundamentally the life of Elijah. By the way, Rahab, probably just in that short chapter of Joshua chapter 2, would probably summarize. I mean, you'll see other places where she's mentioned, but Joshua chapter 2 would be where you'll read about her. But as you read about Elijah, what is clear is this is a man that's determined. Now, here again, some people, determination, you know, it's not a big deal, but Elijah is a big deal. And it's also very clear, this is why, you know, he made such a good prophet. He's very unambiguous. I mean, you know, if he's going to tell you something, there's no doubt he's going to be direct. And you're not going to be scratching your head going, hey, I wonder what he meant by that. He's going to tell you what he meant. If he thinks you're stupid, he'll say, I think you're stupid. And if he thinks that you need to die, he'll say, you need to die today. And he doesn't have any apology, very uncompromising about the way that he does things. He's very pious, that is to say, he's very godly in his stances. He's very competitive. You can see the nature that he has. We listed under here orthodox, which means there's a strict adherence to religious doctrines, laws, creeds. It needs to be done this way. And, you know, Elijah's just one of those guys that's just not going to go one way to the right or one way to the left. He sees everything black and white. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. He's very concise, very unyielding. He's conservative. So if he's running for office, he'd be an ultra-conservative. And he'd be very direct. If you were to ask him what he values the most, he would say justice. Elijah would say justice. And this is why he's such, as when it says that John the Baptist is going to come in the spirit of Elijah, I mean, John the Baptist came proclaiming the law, and he says, you need to get right. And it was all about doing right. It's all about justice. And of course, he was the last prophet, John the Baptist was the last prophet of the law. And so, you know, I mean, he would even go up to Herod and say, you shouldn't have your brother's wife. Of course, he'll get his head chopped off because of that. But he knows what he believes, and he'll come, and he'll declare it without any apology. This man loves justice, and he wants to see it done. Now, what's very strange about the example that's given in the book of James in particular is that he prayed that it would not rain for 3.5 years, and it didn't, and then he was called upon God. God told him, okay, it's time to pray now for full rain. And he does. That's very unusual. And I'll tell you why it's very unusual. Because when he prays that it rains, let me just back up. Why would somebody pray that it not rain? Why would somebody pray a famine? Well, there's only one reason. God's judgment upon his people. And we know who's in control. Ahab and Jezebel. Not shining lights. So he sends them to them. And of course, she has all these prophets. Of course, she, towards the end, tries to kill them. It's at this time he has to pray for rain. And what's interesting to me is Jezebel still alive? She's still wicked. And she still hates him. And she still has her army of false prophets, even though he killed 850. In other words, the nation did not change. And you want to know something? Elijah will be taken up into heaven. I think it's 2 Kings chapter 2. Elijah will be taken up into heaven, and it will not be till 2 Kings 9 that Jezebel dies. He will not be on this earth to see Jezebel die. He will prophesy that she will die. And he will prophesy God's judgment upon her, but God will not allow him to see it. He will have to relinquish his sense of justice. This is a very important issue here, if you can comprehend this. Because God is going to be telling you, and he's going to be telling me, that there are certain things that you're going to have to let go, and you're going to say to him, you're going to say to God, yes, but it's unfair. And he's going to say, you don't know the whole picture. You're going to have to trust me on this one. You're going to have to trust me that my timing is perfect. You're going to have to trust me to make sure that justice will prevail. You're going to have to trust me that I'm in control. Things are not out of control. And you're going to have to let the whole thing of justice go. That's going to be the hardest thing for Elijah to do. That's going to be the hardest thing to do. In each of the cases, these individuals are having to surrender something very valuable to them. And let's just reemphasize this. In every case is something very good. But those very good things are getting in the way of very godly things. And that is putting your trust and your faith in God. And God's going to push you. If you're going to grow, God's going to push you to those limits. God's going to move you in those areas of your life. And you can sit and argue with him all you want to, but what's going to happen is he's going to begin to work on you in the realm of, here comes the word, endurance. And it's going to be through that long haul that all these things are going to start coming up. I can tell you that 20, 30 years ago, if you were to ask me, you know, are you a pretty nice guy? Are you a pretty generous guy? Are you a pretty helpful guy? Are you a pretty caring guy? I'd probably go, yep. But you know what? Through the process of hardship, of trials, of people doing hateful things, destructive things in my life, I realized I had limitations in those things. And I realized that in a lot of those areas, that was me feeling, you know, pretty good about myself, but I really wasn't walking by faith, that it wasn't the faith of God that was moving me, it was just that I was a nice guy. But I can tell you this, if you're just a nice guy, it's got limitations, because you have limitations. And some people, all their life, they never get past the, well, I feel like I'm pretty good. And they're never going to go into the realm of maturity. But some of us, God's going to take us into the realm of revealing to us, you know what? You're not nice. And until you start putting your trust in me and trusting me for the things I do, you'll find yourself getting more and more and more and more upset. You're going to find yourself fighting anger every day. I remember a day that I shook my head. I go, why am I so upset all the time? You ever had those days? You don't even know why you're so upset. Everything's just ticking you off. It doesn't take much to do that. And this is what I was saying. You know, it's a sign that there is something that you're not letting go, and I can almost guarantee you it's probably something really good. But it's the very thing that's holding you back from best. And God's not going to let it go. God's going to keep, and this is why he uses the phrase in James chapter 1. He says, and let endurance have its perfect result. Let me word that another way. Let endurance perfect you. Because that's what God's doing. See? He's bringing you into the realm of, and we oftentimes translate the word perfect because it's oftentimes meant this way, as maturity. In other words, your Heavenly Father is helping you grow up. And the only way that you and I are going to grow up is if we walk by faith. Because there's no way that we're going to be able to handle all the difficulties, all the problems. You're going to go on overload. You know, when things are fairly mild and things are going quasi the way you think they should, you'll be okay for a while. You'll even feel so good about yourself that you'll have days in which you'll pat yourself on the back. But it will not last. And God is saying, Let's take this up a notch. And you're either going to see God as one of two characters. One, you'll see him as a thief because he took what was valuable to me. In fact, if you look with me in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, it is this phrase that is being used in the text and talks about, of course, the time which Christ will come. And if you read with me in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, it reads this way. Now, as to the times and the epochs, brethren, you have no need of anyone or of anything to be written to you. For you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come, and look how he describes the day of the Lord. Like a thief. And that's a very strange way to describe such a magnificent day to us as Christians. But he's not addressing the Christians. You see, you read in Revelation chapter 19, and Christ is coming on this white horse, and the armies with him, and the marriage supper of the Lamb, and what a day of rejoicing, as the song goes, that will be. But not to some. Because the day when Christ comes in their lives, he'll be like a thief. Why? Because the day when Christ comes in their life, he's going to take everything away that they feel is valuable to them. And it's because it's on this earth. The text reads this way. While they are saying, verse 3, so we know it's they and us, right? They. While they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon not us, but them suddenly, like birth pangs upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. Watch verse 4. But you, brethren. Now we've changed the pronouns, right? But you, brethren, are not in the darkness that the day should overtake you like a thief. Why? Because this isn't my home. Take me home. I'm not leaving anything behind. Don't you see Jesus coming as a thief? No. And the same thing is true when you have trials. If you go back to James, I want you to go back to James, and I want you to see this. Because, look, the point is that these people were feeling, many of them were wrestling with, he's taken away everything that I feel is good. And God says, I'm not doing that. I'm trying to give you good. It reads this way in James chapter 1. And, you know, of course, one of the statements that they're making, verse 13, is, you know, God is just tempting me to do bad because he's taken away the things that are valuable to me. And he says, you know what? He says, verse 16, don't be deceived. Every good thing bestowed and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow shifting. In other words, you can either see God as a thief when you go through those trials, or you can see him as a father trying to give you something. It's almost like he's trying to pry our fingers off of something that we're holding on so he can give us something really valuable. Don't hold on to that. It's going to mess you up. Hold on to this. No, you're taking it from me. And God says, I'm not taking it from you. I'm trying to give you something that will hold you, a solid rock that will keep you. I want us to end tonight by looking at the passages, verses 9 through 11 in James chapter 1. James chapter 1, verses 9 through 11. This verse, verse 9, comes right after he uses an interesting phrase, and the phrase is double-minded. Let me just say this, that in order for you and I to be sane, we cannot be double-minded. Here again, this is going to be one of the themes that he hounds upon within the text. In fact, he will tell us, receive the word of God implanted, which is able to save your psuche or your soul or your psyche. God is desiring to rescue you from insanity. What's going to make you insane? I'm going to tell you what's going to make you insane. You don't have to try to figure this out. Anger. Anger will make you go crazy. Scripture will tell us in Matthew chapter 18 that if you hold on to bitterness and you're unforgiving, tortures will come in your life, and those tortures are not going to let go of you. So, you know, if you want to go crazy, hold on to your anger. But James is saying, but there is another way. And you have to come to realization and understanding that what God is doing is he's trying to give you better. Now, you're still wrestling with him saying, but this is good, this is good. Stop saying that. Do what he says. Let this happen. You know, I've got to hang on to my family. Really? You're going to do that? You're going to have to let go. Watch God fix them. That's a much more sane place. Can you imagine trying to figure out how you're going to keep and hang on to these things? How? That's going to drive you nuts. And you're not only going to go bonkers, but you're going to get frustrated and angry and upset, because I can guarantee you it's not always going to work out the way you want it to. He says this in verse 9, but let the brother of humble circumstances. It's a great phrase, because the description in the Greek is just it's a person that will not get up from the ground. That's a great picture, I think. Yeah. What are you doing down there? I belong down here. You know. Why aren't you getting up? You know what? When the lightning hits, I'm safer. And you know, they oftentimes say that lightning hits the what?
Highest point.
Which, I don't know about you, but you know what? I think I'm safer. Let the brother of humble circumstances glory in his high position. Kind of reminds us of Matthew 20:26, where Jesus says, you want to be great in the kingdom? Then be the servant. Be the least. So, are you feeling pretty low down? Yeah. Congratulations, you made it to the top. Basically what God is saying. And let the rich man glory in his humiliation. That is to say that he is put low to the ground. Now, the way that this is described within the passage is making reference to not only physical or monetary value or worth. So sometimes we read rich man, you know, in the sense of, well, he's talking about money. Not necessarily. Because if you look at about Abraham, if you were to ask Abraham, are you a rich man? He would not talk to you about his money. What Abraham would say is, yeah, I have a son. His name is Isaac. I'm a very rich man. If you were to ask Rahab, are you rich? Yes, I finally have security. If you were to ask Job, are you rich? He says, yes, I have my reputation. It's intact. There's something in your life that you consider as rich. It's what makes you rich. God says, guess what? Until you get low in that area, until you get to feeling like, you know, this was the thing that I was really good at, and now I've even failed at that. Have you ever heard people say that? I really excelled in this, and I can't even do that. And God goes, good, we're almost there. Because until you get to that low position in that high place, you can't be all in your faith. Because there's this double-mindedness in the sense of, you know, okay, I'm going to trust God. I can handle this one. And that's you. And Scripture says that's double-minded. And if you look with me in the way that it describes this in verse 8, being double-minded man, watch the phrase, unstable in all his ways. You could put in there the word restless. You could put the word unrestrainable, because literally the translation is, you can't restrain this person. He's nuts. Why? Because he has divided interest. He has no stability in him. There's no sense of purpose. There's no sense of, I've got this. There's no sense of, you know, I'm confident. Because you really can't have confidence if you're not all in faith. It's the long haul. It's the difficult issues of our life that seem to just stay there. Stay there. Stay there. That's perfecting us. Because anybody and everybody can be good one day a week. It's the endurance that displays the genuine. And God is trying to take you out of the realm of, you know, most of the time I'll trust God, into all of the time I trust God. Let the rich man glory in his humiliation, because like, and he gives this description, because like the flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and his flower falls off. There's two things that are mentioned within the text, the grass and the flower that falls off. And the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. The flower, of course, making reference to the beauty of the appearance of the grass. In other words, you look at a blade of grass and you go, it's just a blade of grass. Although they say if you take a blade of grass and you put it under a high-powered microscope, you can actually see thousands upon thousands of little flowers that actually make up the blade. But it goes on, and of course, we know that certain kind of grass has flowers with it. And his point is that the grass is a green and living thing, but there are the works of man that he takes great pride in. And once again, if you were to ask Abraham, what do you take great pride in? What is the beauty of your life? And he goes, it's my son. It's my son. What is it for you? Because Scripture's going to say, whatever you have produced is going to wither as quickly as when that sun rises. And, you know, there's a reason why it talks about when the sun rises, because what it's talking about is at the peak of the day. And what that's talking about is it will oftentimes happen at the highest point of your life. But that's when the heat oftentimes is turned up the most. And it begins to reveal that you really don't have the power. And you begin to see things start withering away from that moment on. That sun gets hot, and from the rest of that day, I've been watching my grass lately with lack of rain. You know, it's raining everywhere else in the city, not in my house. I'm pretty sure I'm doing something wrong. But that's a confession. but you realize that you need that rain during the day, because how fast within just that short 8, 7, 10, however long hours of that sunlight, that grass is starting to wither up. And he's saying, that's how fast. And you think that you're producing something of great value. I mean, here again, talk about whatever you value the most. And God says, it's going to wither. It's going to wither. It's going to wither. You go, that's the beauty of my life, and I'm going to make it happen. He goes, yeah, but it's not going to last. God is trying to take us out of the realm of working for something that's not going to last. You know, I've seen parents come and go. They brag about their kids. They brag about the family. Of course, everybody's a good parent as long as their kids never make it into the teen years. Teen years are very revealing. But, you know, my kids listen to me, and they're, you know, tell them, Mark, well, congratulations. Let's talk to me in about 5 or 10 years. But the realization is, as parents and those of us who have some years behind us, is you come to realize that unless God rescues that child, I have no hope. Because every child makes their own decisions. Even if you were perfect, which you're not, they're going to have to make that decision. And unless God builds a house, we labor in vain who build it. I mean, it's as the psalmist says, it's futile for you to rise up early, to go to bed late. God will give to his beloved even in their sleep. Don't think that you can control these things. But unless you and I come to the point of that faith, he ends the text this way. The sun rises with a scorching wind, withers the grass, its flower falls off, its beauty, its appearance is destroyed. So too, here's the analogy, so too is the rich man. Now I want you to stop here. So too is the person who feels pretty confident in whatever. Whatever you feel confident in, you're the rich man. So too is the rich man as he begins to pursue his ways and think, I got this. I got this. So as we go through the book of James and begin to look about the issue of anger, I'm going to tell you that if you're wrestling with anger, probably one of the main reasons is that you're being attacked in an area you're going through tribulation in the area that had been hitting you for a while, and you're feeling stuck. And in that feeling stuck, you're feeling very frustrated and upset. And God is turning to you and says, I'm trying to give you something good. I'm trying to give you something better. And you're fighting him. So we'll be talking about how he deals with us in that as we go through this book and teaching us how to let go of this anger. Working through faith without works is dead. So what are we going to do? We're going to work through this anger thing. Because that's he's very much dealing with the issue of anger. Father, we give you thanks for your word and give you thanks for these examples that you give us in your word. We just pray that you would speak to our hearts as you begin to take us on this journey and as you desire to give us far greater things in our life than we could even ask or think. We realize that you're not a thief at all. You're good, benevolent, loving, generous, Heavenly Father. Of this we are convinced. We give you thanks in Jesus' name.